Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. I'm Beth Pike, and thank you for joining us. On today's broadcast, our host, Craig LeBeau, is going to be talking with Stacy Pratt. And Stacy is the executive director of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. And also we'll have Celeste Dixon talking about the execution of a man that was murdered, that had murdered her mother. We'll be talking about that, and we'll also be taking calls later in the broadcast, so you'll want to have your questions ready. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show, and then, as always, we have our 420 drug war news at the end of the show. But up now, it's Craig and his guest.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And this is Craig LeBeau and my guest, Stacy Pratt. She's the coordinator, director of the Missourians for the Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Welcome, Stacy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And you've been doing that 2 years now?
2 years now.
Right? Okay.
Celebrate in January.
All right. Today we're going to talk about kind of two things. Originally we were going to talk about one, and we added a second thing.
Sure.
The first thing we're going to talk about is back earlier this year, there was a study released from Harvard, I guess, about prosecutor misconduct. So we're going to talk about that. Missouri was at the top of the list, or close to the top, for prosecutor misconduct and the impact that that has had on possible on the death penalty cases, as well as innocent people being convicted. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the death penalty itself. On Election Day this year, there were two states. California had two measures on their ballot. One was to repeal the death penalty, and that failed. And the second measure was to speed up the appeals process to essentially, I would say, that to execute people faster. And I believe that passed.
That's correct.
And then in Nebraska, the legislature, about a year or so ago, had repealed the death penalty. And then that was on the ballot. The governor of Nebraska wanted to get it reinstated, and the reinstatement passed, I believe.
That's correct, yes.
So we'll get to talk about that in a second. So let me get into first the study on the prosecutor misconduct. If you can just summarize that, how it was done, the top findings.
Sure. I think this is a really interesting analysis that was put out by Harvard, the Fair Punishment Project. And so often when we're looking at criminal justice issues, we see them in broad sweeps, but don't necessarily examine in practice what's happening. So the America's Deadliest Prosecutor report reflected specifically on Missouri. Number 8 and number 9 are Nels Moss and Dean Waldemar. And I think it's important to understand that the death penalty, as it is in practice, is really the result of individual prosecutors and their determination to pursue a death sentence at all costs. When we look at Missouri, for example, just 2.6% of our counties in the state represent over 80% of the executions that have taken place. So while you get the idea that the death penalty is practiced broadly, the majority of Americans live in counties that have never actually produced a capital sentence. That tends to be St. Louis City and County, Jackson County, and Callaway County historically. So I think that's a really profound understanding of what's really happening in practice. Overall, when you come to jurors and Americans individually, they're rejecting the death penalty. The state of Missouri has not had a new death sentence in the last 3 years, even though there have been over 30 capital prosecutions. I tend to think jurors are closer to the reality of capital punishment. They're looking in the eyes of the individual who is facing execution, and they're understanding that this is a very broken system. As highlighting that people are rejecting capital punishment, what's happening on the local field, what's happening on the ground. we saw in the election process, and we saw through the prosecutor's report, that a really interesting thing happened. When you look at the broad brushstrokes, certainly there are challenges in California and Nebraska, but five of the deadliest counties lost prosecutors and, in fact, have been replaced by reform-minded individuals. We also see that in St. Louis City. For the first time, we have an African-American elected as the circuit attorney prosecutor, Kim Gardner. And that's actually falling on the heels of the legacy of Nels Moss, who was an individual who engaged in deliberate misconduct, as identified by the Missouri Supreme Court.
And before we go on, we do have a caller already
On
the line.
Sorry.
And caller, could you state your first name and where you're calling from?
Okay. This is Celeste.
Oh, okay. All right. That's our next guest.
Okay.
All right. So we'll get to you in a few minutes, and thank you for being here, Celeste. All right, so go ahead.
Sure. So what I think is really interesting, when you look at November of last year, let's go back in time, November 25th of 2015, the Missouri Supreme Court came out and truly rejected the practices of the St. Louis City Prosecutor's Office and Nels Moss specifically. It was the Reggie Clemens case, and they identified that the prosecutors suppressed evidence that the police had beaten Reggie Clemens into confessing. And that was deliberate, that they told the police officers to hide evidence of the injuries. And that played heavily into the Missouri Supreme Court's decision to set aside the verdict and say, you know, we need to look at this again. And we need the city prosecutor to decide whether or not to once again go for capital punishment in Reggie's case. Well, it's very interesting that now we have an absolutely new phenomenal prosecutor in St. Louis City, Kim Gardner. And I think in many ways we're seeing that the politics of abusing race in the criminal justice system, which has been particularly problematic in areas like St. Louis City and in Ferguson, have been rejected. We have a new prosecutor based on the phenomenal work of the Organization for Black Struggle, of the NAACP, and the recognition that the behavior of prosecutors is truly what's driving the death penalty and the practices of criminal justice that have been tainted by racial bias. So I think it's a new day. Yes, on the big level, you know, some of the elections, I think, you know, when people put things on the ballot, you can think about it in a very abstract way, like the death penalty. But when you're a juror, it's a very different reality. So I think that there's still a lot of hope for change.
And so of the five deadliest prosecutors, and two of them have been replaced?
My understanding is many of them have been retired in the deadliest prosecutors report, but what we're seeing is current prosecutors who have embraced the death penalty have now been replaced.
All right. And of those who have not been replaced, which ones are still of a concern?
I think there are a number of prosecutors who are of concern. We certainly see that there have been capital sentences pursued disproportionately in areas in the South, particularly in Georgia, in Texas, and in Florida. So I think this is just a matter of focusing on those prosecutors who are still engaging in a push for the death penalty.
Okay. And what happens when there's prosecutor misconduct? I know a lot of times cases have been to the appeals courts and they'll say this was improper conduct, but then they say it's harmless error and they don't reverse.
Now, that's truly an interesting question. You know, one of the things that happened when you're dealing with, for example, Reggie's case, you know, the conviction was actually set aside. The death sentence was set aside, sorry. And that's not all that common, even in cases of prosecutorial misconduct. What other states have done is they have established conviction integrity units within the prosecutor's office to deal with prosecutors who go beyond the line, who hide evidence, who engage in racially biased jury selection. The idea is that the system depends on the integrity of the prosecutor. The prosecutor has tremendous discretion in terms of deciding whether or not to seek a capital sentence, and also whether or not to employ a variety of tactics in selecting juries and going for life without parole or going for capital punishment. And so I think there needs to be a conviction integrity unit, particularly in those offices that have been identified as misbehaving.
Okay. And what about maybe are there any states in which the judges are allowed to intervene and say you're not going to be able to seek the death penalty in this case? It's not appropriate before taking it to trial.
Yeah, that is a very difficult question because most of that is entrusted to prosecutorial discretion. I do think there's certainly a basis for citing individual prosecutors when they engage in fraudulent practices before a court of law that can be cited for contempt by a judge. And I think there's a larger issue. I think the legal profession overall has an interest in making sure that prosecutors behave appropriately, that the Prosecutors Association has that interest and can sanction their own members. And I think it all comes down to really making sure that there are procedures in place to check prosecutors. Frankly, right now, there aren't many effective ones. When a court does intervene, the process has to be incredibly egregious and has to have evidence, which can be difficult to show. But we did it in Missouri. And so I think that shows that that's just the tip of the iceberg. So often these things go under the radar. But this one was very egregious.
And these integrity units, are these independent, or how are the people selected to be reviewing these?
So the conviction integrity unions are typically part of the prosecutor's office, but they are independent from the individuals who are the prosecutors who are choosing the sentences. And so it kind of depends on the state in terms of how they're structured. But I think that they have been proven to be very effective tools in overseeing prosecutorial misconduct and discretion. And it's something that we should examine in Missouri. Yeah.
And in terms of the time span, let me ask you, in the Clemens case, if you know, between the time he was convicted and the time that the conviction or the sentence was finally set aside, what time span were we talking about?
I am not familiar with the exact year of his original conviction, but we're talking decades. We're talking okay. an incredible amount of time. And I think that that's one of the challenges, too. It took that long for this to come to the surface, even though the misconduct occurred years ago, decades ago. And it was only in 2015 that this was able to be set aside.
Was that misconduct something they knew about early? And was it raised?
I think it was very difficult to discover the extent of the issue. And so that's why it's taken time to wind through the courts.
What sort of discovery process is there by statute or case law that helps to facilitate innocent people and their attorneys being able to find out this information?
You know, that's a great question, probably more so for the folks at the Midwest Innocence Project in terms of what tools are available. You can use the traditional discovery tools, but one of the challenges is whether or not people are forthcoming with information. If you have a system where the prosecutor can instruct the police to hide evidence and they follow suit, you can imagine it's very difficult to find that information. There's an incentive not to share it. So that is the challenge.
All right. Let me move then to the other issue, which we kind of addressed a little bit with those two other states.
Right.
With
California and Nebraska.
California and Nebraska and the reinstating of it in Nebraska. How is that going to impact, well, two things. Do you have a concern about a negative impact on how people in Missouri view it, on public opinion, and how is that going to affect gain progress in the legislature if they're looking at, you know, these legislators, if they're fence-sitting and they're thinking about maybe voting to repeal, but then they see what happened in those two states. So what do you see as the impact? And how might this affect the strategy of both the organization as well as the coalition against the death penalty in other states?
No, those are great questions. So I think what it comes down to, what we've seen over and over again, what the support for the death penalty is a mile wide and an inch deep. That's what I've heard many activists say. And I think it's very accurate. When you ask people in just very general opinion polls or in a very general sense, you often see support for capital punishment. But then when you change the frame and say, if the only alternative is life without the possibility of parole, the majority of people in Missouri and elsewhere support life without parole. And I think you have to have a nuanced conversation rather than one that is simply a knee-jerk reaction to the idea of capital punishment. One is a fiscal argument, and this has actually not disappeared. Even on the federal level, one of the areas that there still seems to be an appetite for progress is criminal justice reform. And the reason is, it's not a partisan issue. This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. It is one that touches on, you know, do you trust big government? Are you comfortable with a program that requires the investment of about $1 million more per case? We all care about public safety. I think that that's an issue that's really important, whether or not you're a Democrat, Republican, progressive, conservative. And we've seen the appetite for this reform cross those political boundaries. And what I would say is, if anything, I think particularly in Missouri, we're in a better place for a conversation. When we're looking at the budget crisis in Missouri, and we're having one, we have to be very thoughtful about where we're putting our public safety dollars. We all want public safety, but how do we best invest in it? Well, if we know defense costs alone in a capital case are about $250,000 more, and that, for example, we have a backlog of rape kit testing in Kansas City that could actually be solved by not doing one capital case, I would say we all would agree that, you know, we need to prioritize our public safety dollars very appropriately in times of budget crisis. You know, I certainly understand that voters in other states may in general support the idea of capital punishment. That's not uncommon. But when you talk to people about, okay, where do you want to spend your money? I think we get a very different and nuanced response. And in Missouri, I have to say, the leadership in our movement is from the conservative folks. Paul Whelan, who is the senator who led the repeal last year, is a Republican. He's pro-life. And those are some of the issues that are really moving to the fore. I think you have to, I would say that all politics is local, that many people support giant ideas, but when it comes to practice, the fact that no jurors, and these are rural jurors, these are jurors from across the board in Missouri, are not endorsing capital punishment, means to me that when you make it a pragmatic manner, when you make it not a matter of a broad sweep issue, people are not supporting capital punishment. And that's true across the country. We have the lowest number of new death sentences, the lowest number of executions that we've seen in years. So I think there's sometimes a difference between people getting caught up in rhetoric, which people do, and the passion of an issue, and then what they do on the ground when they say, wow, we as a municipality don't want to have to raise taxes in order to do capital punishment, mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
All right, so let me bring in Celeste Dixon. Celeste, are you there? Celeste?
Oh, hello. Sorry,
okay.
I thought I hung up.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. So we're bringing in Celeste Dixon. Celeste, her mother was murdered in Texas, and Celeste lives in Kansas now. And first, let me have you, if you just start out telling us the background of the case and what happened to your mother and the happened during the prosecution of the case?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was actually stationed in the Navy in Puerto Rico. I was at Roosevelt Roads Navy Base, and so I found out about it after it had happened, but apparently the guy who did this, his name was Michael Richard, had just recently gotten out of prison. He had been in prison for robbery, and we lived in a very small town in Texas, and I guess he had a gun. He went out one day walking around, and he stopped at our house and asked about a van in the driveway if it was for sale, which it belonged to my brother, and it came out later that that's just how he would kind of check out a place. He would go if something was for sale, or he'd come asking if something was for sale that he saw so that he could look inside and see what was available. But anyway, my mom was there and a couple of my siblings, but they were all getting ready to go. And my mom was a nurse, and she worked nights, so she was actually getting ready to go to bed. She had to work that night, and my brother and two sisters and a brother that were there, and they left to go do things. And anyway, my sisters came back, I guess about 9 o'clock, and came in and noticed that all the lights were off. And anyway, they went across, felt that something was wrong. They went across the street and got a neighbor who had a gun, a shotgun. And anyway, they came in and looked around and discovered my mother, who had been shot. And the evidence later showed that she had actually been shot at close range in the head. And so I came home from the Navy for 2 weeks of leave, and they actually caught the guy and got a confession. But he didn't actually say it. He said that the gun went off by accident. So the confession that they got was, I mean, he said he did it, but he never directly said, I shot her, you know, on purpose. He claimed that the gun went off by accident, but they had a confession. And this was in, although we lived in a small town, we were right on the edge of Harris County, Texas, which Stacy may know is one of the counties that sends the most people to death row. At the time it was, and I think it still is, the county that sends the most people to death row in the country. And the prosecutor, there was really no question. And I think, and I learned later, you know, when I started to, research capital punishment, and found out that oftentimes it's not the race of the offender. It's usually the race of the victim. And of course, my mother was white, middle class. And I just think there was no, I don't think the prosecutors even considered any other option other than the death penalty. And one thing that I noticed is it really was a, you know, we're all in this together, the prosecutors, and I mean, they should be, they are on the side of the public. And I won't say that they said, you know, we will get the death penalty for this guy and you'll feel better, but it was presented as sort of a, you deserve this, this is all for you, you know, this guy took your mother's life, we need to take his life. And I had never really thought about the death penalty. I guess I was for it in the sense it was a broad theoretical support. It was, well, you know, that makes sense. You take someone's life, you should forfeit your life. And you know, being involved in all of this, I really started looking at this guy as a human being. I looked at his family, the impact that this was going to have on his family, and also the fact that one of the jurors told my sister and me when we were standing in the lobby of the courthouse after it was all over and we had gotten what we thought we deserved, which was capital, you know, the death penalty. One of them said, came up and said, I just want you to know that some of the jurors were holding out for life in prison, or some of the jurors were considering life in prison, but I held out for the death penalty because I thought that's the least you deserve. And I remember thinking at the time that, while I was grateful at the time, because I, you know, at that time I was, you know, really thought that's what we wanted and needed, I remember thinking that, you know, that's not really the criteria that was supposed to decide whether or not he got the death penalty. In Texas, there's, at the time, this was 25 years ago, or 30 years ago, the jury, they would decide guilt or innocence, and then in order to impose the death penalty, the jurors just had to answer whether the crime was intentional and whether this person presented a future danger to society. And I remember thinking on that second question that the evidence that the defense or that the prosecution presented didn't seem to give that a yes answer. He had shown no violence. This was the first time. I mean, I remember being worried during the trial, thinking, well, they don't seem to be presenting enough evidence to answer that question yes, so he's probably not going to, you know, the jurors probably aren't going to answer it yes. But anyway, they did. But these were all things that I started thinking about, and seeing his mother in the hallway after the verdict had been rendered, and she was crying, and it just sort of hit me at that time that, you know, she was going to lose her son. We had lost our mother, but she was going to lose her son. So all of these things just sort of kicked around in my head for a while, and I finally just got to the conclusion that the death penalty was not really the answer to this crime. And I really felt...
When you...
I'm sorry.
Okay. When you said before, too, that they it seemed like they never considered an alternative, did the prosecutors at least meet with you and your brother and your other family members to get your input before they made that decision?
I don't remember that they did. I remember it being the decision was already made when they met with us. I think, but honestly, that was 30 years ago, and I don't remember. They could have, but I seem to remember it as you know, that it was Harris County, Texas, right. And I don't think the prosecutor at the time, whose name was Johnny Holmes, was really going to consider anything else.
All right.
And actually, I think. Right before the trial started, Michael's attorney did approach the prosecutor and say that he wanted to deal, and they pretty much said, no way. We're not dealing.
You know,
this is going to trial.
That's. I just want to support you, Celeste. I think what you're saying is so profound. And we have seen that in practice, too, that a number of prosecutors simply assume that the victim's family will desire death. And I think it's worth a conversation. Certainly in my work, I've worked with a number of folks who have said, you know, whether based on their faith background or your profound understanding that, you know, this doesn't give you closure per se, but is not the answer, that those conversations haven't taken place with the prosecutor simply because they assume that there's support for the death penalty. And that's genuinely not always the case.
Right, and I think also there's a societal expectation,
right,
that's what we want.
Right.
I know a lot of times if I you know, it's not like I talk to a lot of people about it. It doesn't come up in daily conversation, but sometimes when it does, people are surprised. He's already been executed. He was executed. Probably about seven years or so ago. It was, well, 2007, so I guess that was eight.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, they're surprised sometimes, and I think it's based on people not understanding the process that victims' family members go through.
Right.
I don't think it, and it's also sort of this idea that that we want revenge, and here's someone that, you know, you can focus your anger on and do something about. And I think it would be healthier to discuss it rather than just assume that that's what you want, that that's what we want.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that, we are trying to do is empower victims to speak out and just to share their perception on, you know, what it's like to go through this process. A capital sentence means you're often going through 15 years of appeals and retrials and reliving, you know, those very difficult days. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that the community and the prosecutors support victims who view the world differently and view closure on a different path. I'm working with a number of victims' family members now who have actually said for pending capital prosecutions, this is not what they want, that in the end, you know, that doesn't give them the closure they desire and, in fact, focuses on kind of vengeance rather than healing.
Right.
We do need to, we're going to take a break in a second here. And then we will come back. Our guest is Stacy Pratt and Celeste Dixon, and we will be back after the calendar and a couple of announcements. When we come back, we will take phone calls, but we will only have one line open for the phone calls. Number will is 816-931-5534.
Now, the calendar for December 5th. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, December 5th from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force's mission is to lobby the Missouri Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and humane, as well as basic human rights and medical care for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's R-E-D-R-O-B, 2655 at yahoo.com. Moore Squared's Missouri Issues Night will be Monday, December 5th, 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., at Trinity United Methodist Church, 620 East Armor Boulevard, KCMO. Committees on Access to Health, Criminal Justice, Education, Immigration, and Workforce Infrastructure Task Force will meet. You are invited to join them in the fight for justice. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, December 10th, from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help you. My name is Jeff Homfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Next week, new host Teresa Wilkie talks with KU Professor Charles Epp about a study of the KCMO police stops, and host Keith Brown-Ill talks with the folks from Families for Justice as Healing. Coming up next is Craig LeBeau and his guests.
All right, we are back, and our guest again is Stacy Pratt from the Missourians for the Alternative Death Penalty, and Celeste Dixon talking about the situation where her mother was murdered and that suspect was ultimately executed, I think you said, in 2007. Is that correct, Celeste?
Yeah, I think it was September of 2007.
All right. And I think when you were speaking at the Kansas Coalition back in October, you said that he was actually, his sentence was set aside and then he was resentenced. Is that right?
Well, I know he got a retrial, so I guess, I don't know if it was set aside. It was just, there was, I guess some issues about the first trial and his defense lawyers got a retrial and, but, you know, once I sort of let go of the death penalty, I didn't really pay that much attention to what was going on with the case. I just decided that that wasn't helping me and I didn't really need to follow it. But I did call the prosecutor in the retrial, and when she answered the phone, she seemed very friendly and welcoming. But as soon as I said, I just want you to know that I'm opposed to the death penalty now, and I just want to, let my feelings be known. And I won't say that, she got rude or anything, but I just felt like there was a change in the way she spoke, or the timbre of her voice, I guess you could say. She just got a little more businesslike. So I felt like, I became a victim that didn't help her.
Do you know, when he got the retrial, do you know if any of that involved prosecutor misconduct?
I don't think so, but I honestly don't know.
Yeah, it seems like your experience speaks to the prosecutors have their own incentive at times to pursue the death penalty. And unfortunately, they don't always take the victim's perspective into account if it doesn't go in line with their own, sometimes political careers. I echo how important it is that your voice matters. And I think that when people are in this horrific situation, the ability to speak up makes a great deal of difference, even if it takes time. And that people should know that what happened to you is often not made better by a situation where a capital punishment is on the table.
Right.
When you said the prosecutor kind of presented initially that this was like for the family and that you deserved this. In what ways, what made you feel like that wasn't something that you really wanted? Why do you feel like you didn't deserve this, or, if there was a, why did you feel like it would not help you maybe with closure or that kind of thing?
Well, like I said, I started looking at the impact that it had on his family. It came out during the trial that he had been abused as a child. So, that just kind of changed my outlook on him. And I just started realizing that, it's killing him wasn't going to bring my mother back. And I just came to realize that I needed to move on in order to heal. And I had this moment, it was probably 2 or 3 years after the trial, where I basically had a dream one night that I attended the execution. And I remember waking up and feeling horrible and thinking, okay, well, I'm actively wishing for another human being to die. And I really didn't like the way that made me feel. And I just realized that there's two separate things going on when you lose a loved one to violent crime. One is that, of course, there's a crime that has to be prosecuted. But the other thing is that you have lost someone and you need to grieve and process the loss. And the prosecution of the crime is not necessarily the way that you grieve and deal with your loss and move on. But I feel that often in capital cases, those two are conflated. They're put together and said, and people are kind of, you're confused, you don't know what to do, you don't know how to deal. It's not a common loss for most people. And so those two things are separate, but they're often brought together in a capital case.
Yeah. All right.
I think the point you made about that there was actually an offer to plea to life without parole is really profound, too. That case could have been at least legally resolved at that point in time without having to go through a trial, right, without having to go through endless appeals. And at least in my work with victims, they've often said, you know, even those who initially supported a capital punishment all the way through an execution, that it brought them no closure. It didn't bring them healing, and that what most victims have found is that by having the case resolved, knowing that you're not going to relive it for the next 15 years, and just being able to get on with the process of healing rather than holding on to the very natural anger and pain is much more productive for them, their health and their lives and their ability to move forward.
We talked about the conviction integrity units too, and I just want to mention for the listeners tuning in, on December 19th on Jaws of Justice here, we will have Representative Brandon Ellington talking about a bill he is introducing in the legislative session, the next session, to establish conviction units, integrity units in Missouri. And Stacy, do you know, are you familiar with the bill he's introducing?
I have not seen the specifics of the bill, but I wholeheartedly support his initiative. He was also a sponsor last year of the Racial Justice Act that would have set aside death penalties where it could be shown that the decision to seek or impose a death sentence was the result of racial bias. And I think that really does play into what happens in Missouri and throughout the nation. You know, we've been able to do analysis that shows in Missouri, you're 7 times more likely to have a capital sentence if you're an African American male who's been accused of killing a white individual. So,
do you know, on this bill he's going to introduce, is it going to make it mandatory for all counties through the entire state that they each have a unit, or?
I haven't seen the specifics of the bill, so I can't speak to that. I know in other states they tend to target them to areas where there are robust prosecution offices, but I'd love to visit with him more about the specifics.
And for callers just joining us, or listeners just joining us, we are taking calls. We have time for probably one or two calls. And the number here is 816-931-5534. So if you have a question or a comment, either for Stacy or for Celeste, give us a call. So, Celeste, one question I wondered is, you said you had a brother, and did you have other brothers and sisters or just one?
I have 4 brothers and 2 sisters, so we're a big family.
And so, did you discuss this with them, and did they all have kind of the same feelings that you have, or do some of them agree with you and some disagree?
I would say that in the beginning, it was all of them were for the death penalty. Well, we were all, you know, supportive of it in the beginning. And then when I started to change my views, I didn't really say anything at first, but eventually it came up. And I have one younger brother who I think said, you know, he wasn't for it, but we're not that close, so I've not talked to him that much about it. And then my older brother, about 10 years ago, we were talking about it, and he said, or no, not 10 years ago, it was after the execution, sometime after the execution, and he said that he had come to the realization that he didn't think it was necessarily helpful, but and I don't think that anybody is to the point where I am, which is to actively work against the death penalty. But I tend to throw myself into causes, so that's just me.
All right. And Stacy, I think about it, there's a meeting tomorrow night in Missourians Against alternatives against right. the death penalty.
Right.
Where is that at?
It's the Unitarian Church right near the Kemper Art Museum. And so we hope you'll join our chapter there. We have chapters throughout the state, actually Kansas City, Springfield, Jeff City, Columbia, and St. Louis. So we very much hope you'll join us there. Our chapters do a lot of this work. We actually reach out to a number of victims' families and just have conversations. I think that's where it begins. I love Celeste's point that sometimes we confuse the criminal justice process as the process of grieving. And I think there needs to be a separation between those two. It's very natural to feel anger and rage and a sense of vengeance when these horrific circumstances happen. But the criminal justice system is not built to be a good grieving process. Unfortunately, it's built to resurrect the wounds and the issues. And so, you know, joining us at the chapter level lets us work with you and have those conversations with victims, you know, wherever they stand, just to know that there is a healing voice and someone who cares about any perspective that a victim is going through.
Okay. And along that line, one thing that comes to my mind is the Celeste, when the prosecutors were telling you that this you deserve this and all that, did they offer you any other sort of services in your family, any services, you know, social services or anything that would help the family heal? Did they, or was it strictly just the business of trying this guy and not doing anything for the family?
No, we were offered information on victim services. I don't think any of us took them up on it, but that those services were offered to us.
And again, I would say, you know, sometimes we've had folks talk to victim services and the assumption is that the family will be pro-death penalty. And I had an individual I was working with whose father was actually on death row and worked with victim services. But when he again took a journey and kind of changed his position and said, you know, I really don't want a death sentence here. The victim services folks were no longer as supportive. I think it's kind of like that conversation you have with the prosecutor when you change position. And again, I think it's just a point to make with prosecutors and victims advocates that, you know, people come to the table with different perceptions and different needs in terms of healing. And it's important not to assume that everyone is supportive of the death penalty because it doesn't always, it just simply doesn't bring the closure that people are looking for.
Celeste, mm-hmm. I know in Kansas, actually I think it's a national organization, there's a group called something along the line Victims for Reconciliation, and I think Bill Lucerner from Kansas is real active in that. Is that something you've been active in too?
Yeah, it's called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. It is a national organization. I've been a member. I've kind of gone up and down in the activity level, and I think the group has also kind of been up and down in terms of how active they've been. But it's just a group of people that got together. It was actually started, some woman in Virginia years ago, probably 20 years ago, and also what's his name? Bill Pelkey, who whose grandmother was murdered in, I want to say, Indiana. I think it's an active group. There's, you know, they do some speaking and some advocacy work, but I think mainly it was started because people family members who were opposed to the death penalty kind of felt alone, you know, that they were oddballs, that it wasn't natural, that they didn't want the death penalty, and it was a way for people to get together and say, this is not what we want, and, you know, there are other voices out there in terms of family members and the death penalty.
And I think it's so important to support those voices. I've worked with Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation, and we're actually in the process of putting together a publication called Voices. And it's simply people who've been impacted by the capital punishment and by murders within their own families who share their journey on capital punishment, which we hope to put out in January as a publication of MADP. And I think the one of the real purposes is to say you're not alone, that there's not simply one mm-hmm. response to a homicide and a horrible circumstance, that the people who, you know, many of our folks come from faith traditions where redemption is a true, meaningful part of their worldview, and want to be able to say, I don't want to take another life. And so our hope is simply to support those voices and say, if that's what you feel, you have a right to the table and you have a right to present that to prosecutors and victim advocates and to impact the criminal justice system. Your voices matter.
Stacey, you had also one thing that occurred to me. You mentioned that Jackson County and St. Louis County were kind of at the top of the in the past,
historically, yes.
Sentencing people to death penalty.
Right.
So that kind of brings up, I wonder what your comment is on this, kind of a stereotype in the past. One would think that the more liberal, progressive counties and lower income counties would tend to favor the death penalty less than people in the rural counties.
Well, I think, again, it goes to what happens with the prosecutors. Missouri's death penalty statute has about 17 aggravators, and they're very broad. So what comes to happen is the individual prosecutor decides whether or not to be a pro-death penalty county. And I think St. Louis is the perfect example. We had Nels Moss, who was one of the deadliest prosecutors, who engaged in prosecutorial misconduct and obtained a vast number of death sentences. And now we've elected Kim Gardner, the first African-American person to sit in the St. Louis Circuit prosecutorial seat. So I'd say it's about empowerment and fighting oppression. I think when you look at some of our jurisdictions, we have a history of folks being in power who don't represent the full diversity of opinion within their districts. And I think we're seeing change. And so that, I think, is what it's about. You know, for a long time, St. Louis City struggled with, even up and through Ferguson and beyond, with the practices of its policing and prosecutorial community. But I think when people wake up, I think when people are aware of these challenges and push for change, change happens. And I think that's what we're seeing in St. Louis and what we can see elsewhere, too.
All right. And we are about out of time. So I want to thank Stacey Pratt from Missourians for the Alternatives to Death Penalty for being here, as well as Celeste Dixon.
Thank you.
And this will be our show is podcast. So for those who just joined us, I hope you will listen to the podcast when that's up. And so thank you for being here.
Thank you for the chance.
Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Recently, Dr. Sanjay Gupta spoke with Seth Myers.
Obviously, we had this election last week. And one of the things that was very interesting, I feel, in the medical community was all of a sudden recreational marijuana was legalized in so many states. You were someone who originally did not think that was a good idea. You've changed your mind. What led to that?
Well, you know, a medicinal marijuana, you know, there were several states that voted on this and it kind of got lost in this election. But yeah. I think it's very important. You know, I believe that marijuana can be a medicine. And you're right. For a long time, I look at the literature. I'm a very fastidious guy in terms of looking at data. And when I would look at the data around medical marijuana in the past, I didn't find it particularly compelling. But what I started to learn, Seth, was that if you looked at all the studies, what you came to learn was that most of the studies were designed to look for harm as opposed to designed to look for benefit. So 94% of the studies over a 5-year period were actually designed to look for harm as opposed to benefit. So the whole system was sort of looking for that harm as opposed to saying that this could be a legitimate medicine. I started to travel around the world, went to other countries. I started to look at laboratories that were not funded by the U.S. government. And a different picture started to emerge. I mean, I used to believe that, you know, people who were in favor of medicinal marijuana were just malingering and wanting to get high.
Yeah.
But the truth is that I think for certain people, not only does it work, it can be the only thing that works, and it would be immoral, perhaps even, to withhold that if it's a therapy that can actually benefit people. So that's where it's been very heartening to see states like Florida, Arkansas. You would have dreamed 5 years ago that they would pass medicinal marijuana in some of these states, and now it's happening.
And so this seems like a wave that is not going to be turned back, and we are basically going to be a country that has legal medicinal marijuana in all 50 states.
It seems impossible to still have a federal prohibition on medical marijuana. We do. We still have it, but it just seems improbable that it still exists. What I will tell you, Seth, is this is the only substance that has been sort of approved by the people. Not the FDA. Typically, all the medications you have are approved by the FDA, and that can be a very good system. But the people in this case have said, look, we don't know why this substance has been demonized. We don't know why it's landed in the place that it's landed, but it can help people, and states all across the country are voting on it. And again, I switched my mind on this after looking at the data, and I just encourage other people to do the same thing.
All right, excellent. Well, that's very exciting news.
Again, that was Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He was appearing with Seth Myers. It's just another example of more and more knowledgeable people standing up, speaking up, demanding a change to these drug laws. What have you done in this regard? Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.